Kate, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Perfect. Good morning, everyone. Great to be here. Not that great regarding the occasion, obviously, but nevertheless. I think guests here are probably smarter and much more informed about what's going on the ground in terms of military assistance and more tactical things. But I think if I could, I was invited to do a bit of a summary and my reflections of this
Exactly.
2 years. So I think I'll probably do just that.
Do you want to start, Kate? Do you want to start maybe whether we can trust our Ukrainian friends to do the right thing? Because this is what evidently seems to be still an issue amongst European and North American leaders in some shape or form. Maybe we can start there, but carry on.
What's funny here is that the more they keep distrusting Ukrainian soldiers, the more of their own people they will have to see dead. That's basically the thing that I'm seeing, probably not that distant future. I think probably up to 5 years, the much more global conflict. And I think I can explain this. So basically, when I was writing my thesis in 2013, I clearly saw the Russian aggression against Ukraine. The way I saw it was, I think, much more local, just saw it for what it is, because of, Putin's imperial ambitions. They're haven't achieved anything as a country, so obviously the need to distract the population from local traumas and like lack of opportunity by finding the external enemy. So that was back then all pretty clear to me. I think about a year ago we would have had these discussions and the summaries of the war, and I believe we were still quite on the positive note. But I think even then it was pretty clear that the war is spilling much outside of the local regional conflict characteristics. And I hear a lot of a lot of laugh and jokes here when someone mentions Third World War, which I find quite funny, because I think anyone who can spot the trends and patterns can see that we're, if not in it, then we are basically on the border, on the threshold. And I think a year ago I was it was more my vision of this was more that the democracies, the Western societies, NATO alliance, and whatever we consider the West for some ideological reasons, was very much having an upper hand. Today I'm very much unsure. I think that West, as you say, not trusting Ukrainian soldiers, or whatever the reasons are, whoever is to blame for delays or very much insufficient support, they very much gave the reason for the countries dissatisfied with the results of the previous world distribution to be much bolder and to be much more decisive in their in their vision and in their support of dictatorship, specifically of Russia. Obviously, America tried to do something in economic measures, because I think they were too scared to act, because of the nukes, were too scared to act militarily. Now it looks like a failure to me, like a bad decision, because obviously economic systems are quite intertwined, and Russia was able to rely pretty well on China and India to buy their gas and oil. So this is one blunder I think we can notice. Another problem, I think we just underestimated those strange, what do we call, backward societies. And we can see that Iran's and North Korean support are actually working there. They're killing people in Ukraine. They're great for Russia, while Ukrainian people keep dying and waiting for this promised things that never arrive on time. So basically, I think the way it looks to me right now is that currently, I am pretty sure about the situation moving into the World War III scenario, but currently I'm not sure that democracies are having an upper hand, or at least any kind of realization where we're headed. And I think everyone could obviously notice what's going on with Israel, Palestine, Venezuela trying to grab a part of another nation, Houthis disrupting all the world's trade. With Chinese economy plundering further into recession, I think Taiwan becomes much more likely. Europe is in the recession. So basically, unfortunately, I mean, obviously, it's a great weekend, really sunny here in London. And in general, everyone wants to have a good time. But I think long-term perspectives, probably 2 to 5 years, are pretty grim if European countries specifically don't get their act together. So yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't really have anything very, very encouraging to say at this moment, because I think we are all only wasting time by not making sure that Ukraine wins as soon as they can. And I don't understand, I don't know how many people understand Russian war strategy or tactics, maybe we should call that. Basically, once they occupied Donbas, they started using people from Donbas, so basically Ukrainians, to fight. So basically what we have now is a bunch of Ukrainians from Donbas are forced to kill their co-patriots. And if we transport this scenario and further into Ukraine, if they take more of the Ukraine, they will they will use the same tactics. So with these amazing tactics for Russia, they can just, you know, go all the way to Berlin this way. So that's also some interesting.
You have to vacate, Kate. You have to vacate the space so that later on they can Russify it. That's their strategy, as always.
It's a very smart strategy. It's horrible and inhumane to make people kill their own compatriots, but it seems pretty efficient. So even if they run out of soldiers, which seems impossible because they have lots of people very keen on you know, going and slaughtering others, they can just use Ukrainians. And later they can use Poles. Later they can use someone else. So I keep having the impression that people just keep thinking it's a very localized regional conflict, and it is horrible that Ukrainians are dying. But it's local conflict, so you know, it's just somewhere there. Which obviously I'm saying all this not because I'm not even living in Ukraine, so I don't have to have such a vision of it, but I see it for what it is, just because I think it's clear from the patterns of what's going on. But despite all of that, I think Ukraine is standing very strong. I mean, in this situation with insufficient help, I honestly don't know how the soldiers, they absolutely inhumane bravery and determination. And I understand why, obviously, because what Russia is doing on occupied territories, it's something probably you wouldn't want to see in the worst nightmares. But I don't know, without the adequate support in time, I don't know how long Ukraine can keep this war localized.
But see, this is Kate. Thank you for bringing this up, because what you're describing, whilst you can do this now out of London, but at the same time, obviously, you are Ukrainian, and you know exactly what's happening. You can get the spirit at this point in time. Failure to act is actually the worst thing which we can say about all of us. We have failed to act swiftly. We have failed to act in order to create a sufficient amount of capacity. We have failed to act to make a difference. And this is where we can actually also actively change it. There's no reason why what you just described has to come to bear. We can still fix this, but we have to act now. There is no time to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not just empty words that we need to act. It's, in my opinion, about our own self-preservation, even much more than altruistic help to any other country. It's just, you know, if anyone in Europe wants to have a peaceful life in the next 10 years, I think it's very much appropriate that they get their act together now. I mean, much faster. Because also I am reading some news reports and some, you know, op-eds, whatever it is. I don't see everything as a Russian psyops, honestly. And what I see is many experts are saying that it is quite possible that Ukraine can fall in the next, basically before Putin's election or around this time. And seeing such analysis, regardless of how much of the psyops it is, I mean, okay, but do people know what happens next? Do people understand that Russians will not stop at this? I'm not sure.
Well, Radek Sikorsky yesterday, together with Ms. Baerbock and Mr. Cameron, gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal panel, because they were there on site at the UN, in order to plead with the UN to actually take some action, which it won't, but use the forum at least. Radek Sikorsky highlighted very specifically that there is no time to lose. He was also the one who advocated that we should not interfere with other nations' democratic process, meaning we should not push too hard. But on the other hand, we should advocate and make it very clear that this is one of the best deals Western democracy or maritime democracies ever had. Half the Russian army has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. The capabilities of Russia are comparatively low. We exceed them, depending on which criteria you use, in terms of GDP, in terms of production capacity, in terms of our capabilities, we exceed them by 25, 50, 80, or a factor of 150, depending on which criteria you set. So there is no way that Russia should be able to dictate what is going on in Ukraine. This, as General McGrane said earlier tonight, to open our segments here, with Volodymyr Omelyan, the former minister of infrastructure in Ukraine, who's now as a major fighting in the CSU, he said everything is a test of will, because will determines how you then set your strategy. It seems we have not yet enough of that. We haven't mustered enough will in the West. And that is a lack of awareness, and you're quite right. So thank you for that. But what can we do from your perspective? How can we shake up the people who need to make these decisions?
I think an interesting point you raised here, Axel, is actually that Russia shouldn't, based on what we know and based on Western superiority, Russia shouldn't really be able to win this war. And I think it's interesting to address that, actually, because analyzing actually Russian, actions and propaganda strategy in the last maybe 10, 15 years, I think it's very clear and very interesting also that Russia has been targeting countries with the largest population. So we can see Russia is very much very strong and very present in throughout Africa. Obviously, Wagner helped there to cement that, you know, support in military ways, but also many people in Africa are very pro-Russian. The same can be said about many Southeast Asian countries, China, obviously. So you can't help but noticing that Russia is strategically targeting the countries with the highest population to become their allies. And what it seems to mean is that they have been preparing for the world conflict for quite a long time, because Of course, West has much more superior technologies, but the technologies don't always dictate the outcome of the war. And if we look at Second World War, Nazis had very good technologies, but Russia, well, the USSR has been sending millions of people to die, like waves and waves of people, even like forcing Dniester, no, I think forcing Dnipro, I think it was like around 700 thousand were killed in like 1 or 2 days. So it's pretty clear to me that the lack of technology they're trying to compensate with the number of people in the potential world conflict. What I think could be done. I mean, honestly, I think not much, because I don't think many people in power have similar view of the situation I have. And obviously, without this view and the understanding that it will come to you, to your country, if the world war situation happens, I mean, it really feels like you shouldn't really be doing much, because, like, if we are quite sober-minded, why should anyone care about another nation far away if it's not going to have a direct influence on you? And unfortunately, this is people's mentality. So I think if more
And that, although it does, because they don't understand economics at all.
I think economics, I think basically if we are getting further into this conflict, it will reflect very badly. Even if you are not being sent to war to fight and die potentially, economic situation will get much worse. The technological progress will fully get diverted into the military sphere, and everything, of course, the cost of everything will rise, like it did when the war in Ukraine, the Russian aggression started. I think now it kind of calmed down a bit, but the everything will, of course. Everyday situation and people, average people, will feel the change. You can feel the situation already with Houthis, and they're blocking the sea routes because companies have to charge much more for the freight of goods. So everything really has a very direct correlation of on our lives. But for some reason, I don't think European or American politicians highlight this part. They only say how there's the poor Ukrainians, they're dying, we need to help them. This is an absolutely wrong way to place to highlight the problem, because there are some good people who would think about the fate of people being slaughtered, but most people will think, well, it's somewhere away. What should I care today? I think we need an absolute change in the narrative, because obviously, unless European mothers want their sons to go and do the same Ukrainian boys are doing today, in 2, 3, 5 years, I think they should be the biggest advocate of stopping all this on someone else's territory. So I think we probably need more shift of narrative, actually talking about the global war scenario. And I feel like everyone, for some reason, is trying to stifle this narrative as something, funny and silly and impossible, while it's exactly what is going on right now.
It's good that you called out the narrative, because we started with this, and our colleague and friend Beefeater had put out a post a little earlier today to specifically address this, that the language of support, as it has been used by some in the West, is the language of defeat. The language of for as long as it takes is also exactly that, a language of defeat. We either help Ukraine and equip it to destroy the Russian invasion and the Russian troops in Ukraine and bring it to victory, or we will have to live with the fact that Russia and the authoritarian regimes will take this, as you quite rightly highlighted, as the pretext and the capability and therefore the opportunity to push forward and destroy democracies on this planet.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. Yeah.
Thank you, Kate. Very much appreciated. And thank you for making time on this anniversary and commemoration date. It's not only the commemoration of those who are lost and who have sacrificed, but it's also the anniversary of Ukraine stymieing the Russian invasion attack in Hostomel and making sure in the first 48 hours that Russia would be forced into a significantly more costly, dragged out and drawn out attack on Kyiv, which only could fail. It's also the anniversary of Ukraine standing up and saying, no way, not today. So in that regard, thank you very much. Very much appreciated. And best regards to London. David Bailey, good afternoon.
Yeah, I had a question for Kate, if that's okay, if she's still got time.
Absolutely, please. Kate, if you please have a minute still for us.
Yeah, so it's about this cognitive dissonance between, you know, people who are intimately involved with what's going on and can join the dots up in particular in the global battle and what's going on in the information space and the general population. You're someone, I think, that's probably a little bit more, let's say, out and talking to ordinary people, for the want of a better way of putting it. You know, I've got my job to do every day, and I'm in the space quite a lot, and I'm, you know, following in the news quite a lot. So I have kind of limited professional interaction with people on the street. But what I feel is that there's just a massive difference. And you know, what I struggle with is how do we change that narrative? Because, you know, basically we are at war. Russia's saying that we're there at war with us. But from my perspective, at least, the man on the street doesn't really realize that and isn't behaving as if his children could be next. And that's really the situation we find ourselves in. I think you put it a bit better than I could, but I say we're basically moving into a geopolitical binary where you've got good versus evil, authoritarianism versus free market liberalism, and this is something which just hasn't come home. The question is, what's needed in order to change that narrative? Is that something that we just need our leaders to do, or is it something that you think we can influence, or is it how do you see that?
Well, you know what coming basically from a post-Soviet country, I think what has been happening is when America was thinking about the best ways to sell Coca-Cola around the world, that Russia has been creating the spying and counter intelligence institutes, the pretty big ones, departments in Moscow. So I think the focus of these two different axes of powers has been quite different. As we can see, most of Russian population is living horribly. However, Russia has enough money to buy foreign politicians and influencers and journalists and very important people for public opinion, while I don't think Western countries are that efficient and smart when it comes to working with people's opinion. And I think this is something that can definitely be worked on. We just need to focus more on the information warfare in various spheres, specifically in the press, in television. Politicians should change their tone. The thing with politicians, and I've been talking about this a lot when I was getting into transhumanism and the problems with the climate change and all of those. The problem here is that they think short term. They never think about the consequences of their actions in 20, 30, 40 years because they know they will be dead. So say climate change, like everyone knew what would happen if they keep their business as usual back in the 80s. But back then, no one really cared because it's not going to be them suffocating from CO2 anyway, you know. So now, obviously, the situation, I think, is much more pressing. Climate change took, what, maybe 50, 60 years to get to the point of almost no return. But the war, the world war, I think it's much more a question of up to 5 years. So I think we should be pressuring our politicians, whoever has longer terms and whoever will have any type of responsibility to their constituents, that they should just, you know, start seeing things realistically. And until we pressure them enough to change their tune, I don't think there is any really reason to look for change.
Which brings us back to advocacy and engagement, and which is what we have been preaching to do here, and we continue to do so because we have seen it work. We have seen campaigns work. We have seen the impact it makes on politicians, and we can all jointly make sure that more people join us in that regard to put their finger on the scales of history. And it is absolutely vital that we keep that civil dialogue open and that we push for it. So in that regard, thank you very much. I can see that we have a question from Ulrich, and then we will have our next speaker coming up. Ulrich.
My name is Ulrich. I come from Denmark, and I have followed the war, of course, as anybody else. And I have a question to Hoffmann, because the last 2 weeks I just wondering why we don't see any V1 rocket-styled missiles produced to Ukraine, because they are so cheap to make, and you can make them carry a lot of cargo as explosives. And if you are putting in modern GPS systems, they could be very precise. They're not so fast. They fly around 750 kilometers an hour. But and a low altitude up to an hour, about a kilometer in height. And I have a question. Why will it be profitable to make such kind of weapons? Because we can see that they don't get the Taurus, they don't get enough missiles. But if they can start up a production of themselves, where they can make those very heavy bombs very cheap, would that be something you can see as a good value for money, or is it just not? Is it too old technology to use in the war?
Axel, can I come in, or?
Yeah, of course. I was just about to ask you whether you heard of carry on.
I did. Yeah, I'm currently in a supermarket, so I'm joining you live from there. I hope there's not too much background noise. All right, perfect. So the thing is, I think it's a question of how much does Ukraine need and how much are they getting. And I would say the absolute minimum that we need Ukraine to receive in terms of long-range strike weapons are 30 a month. I would say below 30 a month, it's really difficult to see how any long-range strike campaign would contribute to any major objectives on the battlefield. And so I think our task actually is, and it's something I've been advocating for a while, is that we should enable Ukraine to build these 30 missile systems, whatever they are, whether they're actual cruise missiles, whether they're some more sophisticated, adapted long-range drones. That should be in our interest to enable Ukraine to get that done domestically. And we can do that. What we need to do is we need to set up a proper supply chain. I, for example, argued that the warhead itself is probably the least sophisticated part of it. And you wouldn't need that sophisticated of a warhead. A simple unitary one would be enough for most military objectives. So you don't need a Taurus-style penetrator warhead. That's something Ukraine can do itself. You've got a bunch of sensor specialists in Europe. So we need to set up as a supply chain that these sensor specialists deliver a guidance package to Ukraine on a reoccurring basis. And then probably you either need French manufacturers or American manufacturers delivering some kind of turbojet or turbofan engine. This really should be a major objective, and I had really hoped that we had started this process long ago spoiler alert, as far as I know, we haven't. And I don't see any plans happening there. But this would majorly, majorly facilitate Ukrainian victory and make the job a lot easier for them as for us. And also, you know, if they produce the weapon systems themselves, there are no political restraints, there are no targeting restrictions attached. So this would really be an absolute win for Ukraine, and I really hope we're getting there.
And I may add one thing to this. The issue with industrial production is, of course, you need to be able to control the whole supply chain, and you need to be able to have people who are capable of operating the machinery. At the moment, a lot of Ukrainians who have been working beforehand as engineers, as craftsmen, as qualified workers, both in the weapon system industry as well as in other heavy industry areas, because they are fit, educated, and good in assessing situations, are now working in a different field. They're in the ZSU. They're actually fighting force, and many have been lost. Building up industrial production is hard, which is why General McRyan highlighted that the integration, both build-up of Ukrainian-owned manufacturing is vital, but the integration of the supply chain and the support and build-out of, say, more weapon system manufacturing capabilities and capacity scaling in Western Europe is apt, or that includes, of course, Northern Europe, but you know this, is absolutely vital. This also matters in one say regard very specifically, and that is learning. The key aspect in war is the adaptation, and Ukraine learns every single day. Its troops learn in direct contact, in combat. They test the new materials, they test the new drones, they test their systems, whether the ATAR system actually works, whether they need to learn something from reviewing Delta, integrating their fire control systems. They adapt ordnance. They have just managed to adapt the AGM-88 HARM to be used in order to take down more aviation assets very successfully. So, which, by the way, Fabian and we have discussed here on this space months ago that they would do so, and they have done it, and they've succeeded. So this learning capability has to be closely associated with the industrial production, because otherwise industry cannot redesign, recalibrate, and deliver the goods which the Ukrainians will need. And that is when we talk about more sophisticated capabilities. We're not even talking about the basics, which are also missing. But you had a follow-up, Ulrich.
Yeah. That's just, I see that we are running out of time because there will come a time where Russia have so much speed on their military production. I saw a documentary, not a documentary, but you know, there's a YouTube channel with the little doll, and he speaks about that Russia last year produced more aircraft, combat aircraft, than they lost as like the fighter just aircraft, not the heavy lifters and stuff like that. And I think we got
that information is not correct. Where you got it from, that is not correct. The Russians have been since the second quarter last year below replacement capability for their aviation forces. Transport aircraft, they even had issues just as well. They are currently not in a position to replace these aircraft.
Okay. But lower tech equipment like tanks and rifles, ammunition, and stuff like that, they are still ramping up their production. And I fear that we look a time where even if we give Ukraine every weapon they want, they cannot win the war because the Russians have set up the production so high, so they cannot keep up with the incoming Russian soldiers with equipment.
Let me help. This is an important feature because many people have these kind of concerns, but they underestimate one thing, and that is the capability which is vested in Western democracies. We do have inventories in the West. We have them predominantly within the United States of America, respectively within the inventories of US forces, including some of them in Norway as pre-positioned stock and pre-positioned inventory. We have more than enough inventory. We have more than enough capability. What is true is that, of course, with the drawdowns in Europe, the so-called consumed peace dividend, we have far less equipment available to European nations at this point in time. The Germans, for example, sold off a lot of their tank fleet to Turkey. Others gave a lot of their aircraft and also tanks to Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, yeah. You name it. We've given those away. That does not mean that we can't reproduce them. We actually have significantly more production capability. The yeah. question is, can we scale up to capacity? And that's a matter of orders. It's not a matter of we can't do it. We can. We can do so actually quite easily. If you really want to produce, and if you ever have an existential conflict, the automobile industry in Germany could produce a lot of the equipment, which, by the way, would be used for what, which then we come to dual use, which would be used for IFV production. You could reconfigure this relatively quickly. This is a matter of will and organization and logistics. But having said this, Ulrich, we have to make sure that we get very quickly to our colleague, Joanna. And then in about a minute or two, we will hopefully have our next guest, Jochen Kleinschmidt, joining us. So stay with us. Don't go away.
Joanna. Yes, fine.
Thank you, Axel. So I just wanted to comment on this Russians ramping up the production. That's what they want us to believe. It doesn't mean that we really have to believe them. There were a lot of postponements in the last 2 years, for example, for the submarines, also for the planes. We still have not seen an Su-57 in the area of the military, as they say, military operation. So they did increase the production with the military industrial complex, and they are able to do this. I was among the first to say we shouldn't underestimate the Russians, but this doesn't mean that they are really producing what they say they are producing. For example, they said 1,600 tanks per year. Yeah, right. I doubt that. We are seeing in the theater tanks that are 60 years old. So yes, they want to convey this idea of Russia being a very big military power and being able to increase production and deliver all kinds of weapons. It's not really as they say. Yes, they do. They do a lot of ammunition. Yes, they have some, you know, friendly countries delivering things to them, but they are not where they would like us to be to believe they are. So we have to be careful about this. And if the democratic countries and the Western world is finally deciding that it has to step up, I think we could really, really cover all the needs that Ukraine has. And I think it begins to happen. Unfortunately, it's late, but it's not too late.
And this boils down back to the amount of orders by state governments. And if you look at currently the Czech Republic doing its bid in that regard, the Czech Republic has obviously, through its participations as well as also in privatized industries, a lot of weapon system manufacturers traditionally, and has retained them, fortunately, for export purposes, some of which are evidently also even companies which stretch the boundary into Slovakia, which has proven to be a very good strategic choice. Some people were afraid of it, but it has moved the needle in view of the need of the Fico government for money. And they know that the weapon system industry and the heavy, say, industry supply chain, including USD and Košice, actually is dependent on having these weapon systems being produced. So in terms of capability, Sweden, Finland, Norway, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland, in addition to the other main nations in Europe, in NATO, who've been, you know, traditionally producing weapons, the other bigger ones, the ones I named all have independent capabilities, large, even sometimes very unique capabilities in their weapon system manufacturing. As to capability and capacity, Europe even today dwarfs Russia. It's a matter of focus, will, and expansion. So, David Bailey, if you could, I presume that Jochen Kleinschmidt is currently in the audience, but we're not sure whether he is on a computer or on his phone, because if he is on his phone, he can accept the speaker request or can actually request the microphone himself. If he's on a computer, that not always works, and we may have to find this out. But David, if you could liaise with them, and then we carry on. In the meantime, I have a question for Fabian. we've been talking about missiles beforehand in quite some detail. And thank you for bringing also that nerdy kind of detail to the forefront, because it is important. One last question as to the harm. There's a huge stock available of these missiles, the AGMs. What do you think? Should we try to advocate more for the EDA being used for old versions thereof?
Well, you just caught me after climbing the hill back to my apartment, and now I'm in the staircase, so I'm a bit out of breath.
I always have good timing.
So, okay. I really quickly want to add a sentence to what you just heard in general, like this whole talk about production and so forth and blah, blah.
Before we recognize our good guest and Jochen Kleinfeld in just 1 second, Fabian, I would just want to close off the discussion on the missiles, because the EDA, yeah, the Excess Defense right. Articles, capability the president has, and there are, as you understand, a lot of older missile types which actually are about to be destroyed this year. There's even some AGM missiles and which could actually fall under this, and they would cost more to destroy than to hand over. Should we not actually focus on this as well and have a little look, see as to the stocks, because there is a lot of them?
I would say in general I make the offer to the Ukrainians. If the Ukrainians believe they can use them and they would be useful, then absolutely send them. If the Ukrainians tell you that, look, there's limited utility, or for these very short range missiles, they might even get our personnel to take on more risks, then would be smart, then maybe that's not the best idea. But I think that's, you know, from my side, you know, there's always utility to harm missiles and stuff like that, anti-radiation capabilities to deny the adversary. It's ISR capabilities that's hugely important in any kind of war. And so in principle, 100% with you, right? And then also with the ATM missiles that you just mentioned, sure, you're right, like in a close air support role, very useful. The question is, what do the Ukrainians need? Do they believe they can actually get an added benefit from these missile systems? If so, send them. If not, then you don't. But yeah, that's my opinion on that.
We remain in agreement on this one. And by the way, the Hawk battery, say, conundrum already paves the way in that regard. The Ukrainians have been arguing. Why they had been offered the Hawk batteries early on, then they weren't delivered, and the Spaniards finally gave a few. If you think about it, when I was young and we were still good old cold warriors and defending Europe against the communists, we had Hawk batteries all the way down from Denmark to Alto Adige to Südtirol. And there were about 2,000 of them. And see where this has gone.